The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January only costs $7.99. It's titled, Five Things You Can Do to Witness Christ. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Five Things You Can Do to Witness Christ by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, equipping you to witness Christ on the front lines. Five Things You Can Do to Witness Christ.
What you and I think of when we think of history would have made no sense to the gospel writers. The purpose of the gospels was not to reveal specific facts about Jesus. It was to reveal truths about Jesus that the gospel writers already believed. Now, what that means is that the gospel is filled with both historical and mystical information, and the job of the modern biblical scholar is to figure out which is which. And that's a process that's been underway for almost 200 years now, actually, in biblical studies.
That's an excerpt from our recent interview with Reza Aslan. He's author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. We're coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. For the next hour and beyond, we're going to be responding to our interview with Reza Aslan. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is going to be our guest. I invite your questions and your comments as well. 1-877-623-6943. Talk back at issuesetc.org or send us a tweet at issuesetc. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris will be with us into the second hour from the Ruth Institute. We're going to talk about a new study on marriage and poverty. It's often been asserted that marriage is part of the key to warding off poverty. There's a new study saying not necessarily, it might be a part, but it's not a panacea. It's not the magic bullet. We'll see what Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris has to say about that. Then Dr. John Sias joins us, part two of our series with him on Witnessing Christ Today, Law and Gospel. He's author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for January, Five Things You Can Do to Witness Christ. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is a regular guest. He's professor emeritus at the University of Bedfordshire in England, a French advocate and barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States, and director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. He has authored and edited more than 50 books, including History, Law, and Christianity, and his latest, Christ, Center, and Circumference. Dr. Montgomery, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you.
Reza Aslan isn't the only one to write a best-selling book that essentially says, look, the Jesus that you find in the New Testament is not the real one. The historical Jesus is found only by kind of peeling away the layers of myth in the New Testament to get to the facts behind those things. Why are books like these so often bestsellers?
Well, probably because of our penchant toward conspiracy theories. We suspect that things are not as they appear on the surface. There need to be hidden meanings. You know, all of the fuss that has gone on for years over the Kennedy assassination and who was really responsible for this and so forth. The problem, of course, is that when we start this sort of speculation, we move away from the concrete historical facts, and the result of this is that what we end up with is really not worth much.
So when we look at these kind of books, one thing that is often not stated, although Reza Aslan is rather clear in stating this has been kind of the fruit of, as he calls it, modern biblical scholarship for the last 200 years, is that this is nothing new, not historically. These claims, while they may come as new to the public, are not new in biblical scholarship, are they?
Oh, that's quite right. This is old stuff. I mean, this goes back to the 18th century, for example. The first person to have set this theory forth, the zealot theory, as it were, was a rationalist by the name of Samuel Reimar, or Ramirez. And fascinatingly enough, the manuscript that he did on this lay unpublished until Who should discover it but Lessing? Lessing, the rationalist 18th century Enlightenment philosopher. It was Lessing, you know, who presented this ditch. He said that there is an unpassable separation between history and ultimate truth, and you can't get to ultimate truth by way of history. Lessing, in other words, was against any kind of historical revelation. So he had no problems at all with Reimaru's theory. And the thing turns up again and again. But it's been totally destroyed way back at the end of the 20th century in Martin Engel's work, Was Jesus a Revolutionary? Engel, H-E-N-G-E-L. This is obtainable. Published by Fortress Press in 1971. And Engel shows without any question at all that you can't get a zealot Jesus, a revolutionary Jesus, without repressing, eliminating tons of material in the New Testament in which Jesus takes a totally different view. I mean, what about Jesus' statement, for example, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's? I mean, no revolutionary is going to say this.
So what is, before we start hearing from Reza Aslan himself from our recent interview, what is fundamentally wrong with Zealot, the Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth?
Well, it purports to be a work of serious history. It isn't. It isn't anything like this. The author doesn't have any proper academic training for doing a work on this subject, none whatsoever. He's an associate professor of creative writing, of all things, and where? University of California at Riverside, a fate worse than death. He took his Ph.D. in sociology. And I must say, this is a little snobbish, but his dissertation consists of 140 pages. 140 pages? When I did my doctorate in theology, serious theology at the University of Strasbourg, this went to three volumes, for goodness sake. In 142 pages, he dealt with Muslim political activism, which hardly gives him any kind of background to deal with serious history. All he does is to swallow the 19th century liberal criticism of the New Testament and assumes that this is normative and goes ahead, therefore, in trying to distinguish what he considers to be myth in the New Testament from fact. And his criterion for doing this, of course, is that anything that is genuinely supernatural turns out to be mythical. So you've just got an anti-supernaturalist bias that creates a picture of Jesus, which is just a reflection of Reza Aslan. It's not a reflection of what's going on in the New Testament at all.
Let's hear from Reza Aslan on what he calls the difference between fact and truth.
See, this is the problem with the modern mind, is that we think that fact and truth are the same thing. We are predicated upon this modern conception of history as an accumulation of empirically verifiable facts and figures. The ancient mind did not think that way about history. So it's a mistake to say that the gospel writers, quote unquote, made stuff up. The Gospels are not, nor were they ever intended to be read as what you and I refer to as history. These are not eyewitness events of things that happened. These are testimonies of faith written many years after the events that they describe by communities of faith.
Dr. Montgomery, you've spent the better part of your career dealing with issues of fact, your legal career especially. How do you respond?
Well, what you just heard is utterly fallacious. There isn't anything one can possibly say positively about assertions such as you just quoted. If you go to the New Testament, the first thing to do is to take a look at 2 Peter 1:16. 2 Peter 1:16, written by an apostle, the Apostle Peter. What does that passage say? It says, we have not followed cunningly devised fables. The Greek there is mouthoi, myths. We have not followed cunningly devised myths when we made known unto you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. We were eyewitnesses of his majesty. Now, that is in direct contradiction with what you just heard. The New Testament writers were perfectly well acquainted with the difference between myth and fact. The Greek myths, the myths of Greek antiquity, were well known. And what we're being told in the New Testament is that this is not that kind of thing at all. Other illustrations of this, I mean, we could go on forever on this, but other illustrations, Gospel of Luke begins with a paragraph saying that he has followed all things closely from the beginning so that what he is setting forth is factually correct. And that passage, the first paragraph of the Gospel according to St. Luke, has been paralleled with Herodotus, the Greek historian, or even better, with Thucydides. These people knew perfectly well the distinction between non-historical literary activity and the description of factual events. And they are saying, we're giving you factuality. We are not giving you some kind of reconstruction according to our personal beliefs. Now, if you happen to be a rationalist, as is our author Reza Aslan, or a rationalist like the members of the Jesus Seminar, critical biblical scholarship, this sort of thing, you will automatically have to regard this material in the New Testament as containing literary mythical reconstruction, because otherwise you are faced with actual miracles. You're with God entering this world and doing things that you can't explain. And so, you know, there's a great gulf fixed. And the New Testament acts as a kind of Rorschach test to find out if a reader is open and willing to accept things that he cannot personally understand, but which have in fact occurred and have been reported by eyewitnesses, or whether the person insists on redoing the world in his own image so that nothing is uncomfortable and he can explain away everything.
We're listening to and responding to our interview with Reza Aslan, author of a New York Times bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. He's professor emeritus at the University of Bedfordshire in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, and author and editor of more than 50 books, including History, Law, and Christianity, and his latest, Christ as Center and Circumference. I invite your questions and comments as we have time. We'll take them. 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. A little bit later in this afternoon of Issues Etc., Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse will be joining us. We're going to talk with her about a new study on marriage and poverty. And then we'll spend some time with Dr. John Sias, part two of our series with him on witnessing Christ. Today we'll be talking about law and gospel. We'll be right back with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery responding to our interview with Reza Aslan, author of the book Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Here's Eric listening in Chicago. Hi, Eric. What's up?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I really encourage people to give to Issues, et cetera, as it's the flagship of confessional liturgical Lutheranism in the world, I'd say, on the media.
Issues, etc. is listener-supported, and you can support the flagship of confessional liturgical Lutheranism in the media by making a secure online donation at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues, etc.
What happens when you take solid doctrine and solid curriculum and combine them with ancient scholars and modern technology? You get Wittenberg Academy, the very first completely online classical Lutheran high school. We are unabashedly Lutheran and offer families a rigorous standard of academic excellence. Students can pick and choose classes, or they can utilize our entire curriculum for their high school education. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Join me for a Lenten preaching workshop Monday, January the 20th at Concordia Lutheran Church in Geneseo, Illinois. I'll be teaching on current problems in Lutheran preaching and biblical remedies for these problems. The registration fee is only $15 and includes lunch. For more information, contact Pastor Gary Wright at 309-236-3882. I'm looking forward to meeting you in Geneseo, Illinois on January the 20th. 309-236-3882.
You know, about a man who is willingly sacrificing himself on behalf of, you know, the poor and the marginalized and the beliefs about the new world system that he holds, to me, as a human being, is much more, I think, inspirational than sort of the Christian theological view that this is all some grand design and that Jesus as God was just simply fulfilling a plan that was written in the stars.
An excerpt from our recent interview with Reza Aslan, author of the book, it's called Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. It is a New York Times number one bestseller. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. He's professor emeritus at the University of Bedfordshire in England, French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States, director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. Dr. Montgomery, Reza Aslan, author of Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, asserting that the event of Jesus' resurrection, the central truth claim of the Christian faith, is no business of historians.
When it comes to the resurrection, that's a tricky subject for the historian. I write in my book that by definition, the resurrection is an ahistorical event, and so therefore historians have no business commenting upon it. But what is a historical fact is the claim to the resurrection. So let me just be clear one more time. The historian cannot talk about whether the resurrection, quote-unquote, happened or not, because that's a matter of faith. It's outside the bounds of history. What we can talk about is the undeniable fact that very soon after Jesus's death, within 2 or 3 or 4 years, the belief in his resurrection had already become firmly embedded in the doctrine of this movement.
Dr. Montgomery, what's your claim? What's your response here?
Well, it's very interesting that Aslan says that by definition, the resurrection can't be considered as history. It's ahistorical. The claims to it can be investigated by the historian, but not the event itself. What does this say? It says that he is an out-and-out rationalist. He has refused to admit that a miracle such as the resurrection could in fact occur. And he does not understand in the least the function of a true historian, and he's not a historian himself. A historian has to investigate all purported events that are of any consequence due to the testimony presented for them. The historian doesn't start out by ruling out the supernatural and refusing to consider anything that claims to be supernatural as worth investigation. The historian has to have an open mind and consider the evidence for any kind of event. I had a very interesting experience along this line some years ago with the American Historical Association. This was just after McNeil's book, The Rise of the West, was published. McNeil, a historian at the University of Chicago. And I was on a panel dealing with this, and McNeil was present. And I said, you know, it's very interesting. You talk about the rise of the West, and you talk about the importance of Christianity, but you don't get into why Christianity succeeded while other competing religious claims in the first century failed. Why is this? And McNeil said, well, it's clear that this is presented as a consequence of Christ's resurrection. But, of course, as a historian, I can't deal with resurrections. And I said, why can't you deal with resurrections? You deal with testimony. You don't, first of all, start out by excluding certain events from the purview of the historian. You've got to be objective in relation to testimony. And if testimony should lead you in the direction of a de facto resurrection, well, so much the better. And this is exactly the problem that Reza Aslan has. He suffers from a serious case of rationalism, and therefore he makes this silly distinction between claims that he can investigate and the object of the claims, which he can't, if they turn out to be miraculous.
Here's Reza Aslan again answering, at least for himself, where he thinks the various stories connected to the resurrection actually came from.
People were saying, well, you probably saw a ghost. Well, does a ghost eat fish and bread? No. So therefore, that's the story that proves that Jesus wasn't a ghost. People said, you know, well, his body was stolen. Well, Matthew takes care of that charge by placing guards outside of Jesus' tomb. Were there actually guards outside of Jesus' tomb? No, that's a myth that the purpose of which is to express a truth, which is that Jesus' body wasn't stolen. But the belief in the resurrection is a part of the liturgical formula. So what I'm saying is that the resurrection is a matter of belief. And what you and I were talking about earlier is the difference in the Gospels, when you read the stories of the Gospels, between fact and mythology, fact and truth.
What's he saying there, Dr. Montgomery, and how do you respond?
Well, he's saying that whenever factual material is presented, or allegedly factual material, such as Jesus eating fish with the disciples after the resurrection, or doubting Thomas touching the wounds in Jesus' side, or the guards at the tomb, all of that must have been added in order to make the thing appear historical, whereas it really wasn't at all. It was simply a matter of belief. Now, that's a very interesting theory, and the question is, how would Aslan possibly support this historically? I mean, how does he know that there weren't any guards at the tomb? Now, this is a concrete example of what his difficulties are, and they're overwhelming. How can he make the statement, there were no guards at the tomb? Was he there? Does he have any special mystical insight into this that goes beyond the eyewitness documents? Of course not. The only way we know what happened is on the basis of the records that we have. And the records say, by George, there were guards at the tomb. And they also present these other events as factual events, not as rationalizations to cover something that is purely a matter of belief.
Here's Reza Aslan again. And I asked him the question at one point. Paul, who obviously writes the earliest account, the earliest claims of the resurrection, even earlier than some of the Gospels, he seems to treat the resurrection as an actual fact. Why is that?
Corinthians was probably written any time between the years 48 to 50. Jesus died sometime between, you know, 30 and 35 is the best guess that we can give. And so Paul is, what's interesting is when Paul is writing that statement in Corinthians in the year 48, what he is doing is actually repeating a liturgical formula, which means that the belief was much, much earlier than 48. So most scholars would say that probably by the end of the 30s, the beginning of the 40s, not only was resurrection a widely believed phenomenon among the early Christians, but that it had already embedded itself as one of the core tenets of this movement. And that's what Paul is reflecting.
Dr. Montgomery, does Paul present the resurrection as his personal belief or as something that actually occurred?
Well, go to 1 Corinthians 15, verses 1 and following. He gives a list of people who had contact with the risen Christ. And he ends this list by saying, and Jesus appeared to over 500 witnesses. The point of all of this is that if the readers had any difficulty believing Paul's experience on the Damascus Road, that it was veridical, they can just ask these other people. As he also said before the Roman governor, Festus, he said, these things were not done in a corner. This stuff is not a sort of hidden faith experience. These events were public events, and there are people living at that time who were able to confirm it. And by the way, 1 Corinthians happens to be 56 A.D. We're just delighted that Reza would like to push the date up to 48. Isn't that comfy? But it wouldn't be a bad idea if he did a little research on the subject to discover what the almost certain date of 1 Corinthians actually is. You've got that kind of historical vagueness and inaccuracy running through all of this. And it's sad that the people who've interviewed him, other than yourself, of course, have not brought out the utter inadequacy from a scholarly standpoint of a book like this and the misleading nature of it.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. We'll take a break. It's Tuesday afternoon, the 14th of January. We are coming to you live. We're responding to our interview with Reza Aslan, author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. When we come back, we'll hear from Reza Aslan on why he does not regard the Gospels as true eyewitness accounts. Stay tuned. Issues, Etc. regular guests, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, Dr. Stephen Hine, Dr. Angus Manouge, and Craig Parton will be speaking at the summer study sessions of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, July 8th through the 19th in Strasbourg, France. For more information, visit apologeticsacademy.eu. The International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, July 8th through the 19th, apologeticsacademy.eu.
Those beautiful notes were just the beginning of We Praise You and Acknowledge You, O God, Concordia Publishing House's debut CD collection from Pastor Stephen Starkey, one of the most significant Lutheran hymn writers of our time. For a limited time, save 10% when you use promotional code URA. Simply visit cph.org today. Lutheran thought, Lutheran substance, Lutheran music, brought to you by Concordia Publishing House.
Are you concerned about weight gain during the holidays? Work out this winter at Arch Fitness of Cottage Hills, Illinois. Arch Fitness offers adult boot camps on weekday evenings and on weekday and Saturday mornings. For more information, check out the Facebook fan page for Arch Fitness or call Kevin Reisick at 618-670-6952. Arch Fitness is located at 127 West MacArthur Drive in Cottage Hills, Illinois. Win the war against winter weight. Arch Fitness of Cottage Hills, Illinois.
Whether vacationing in Branson or boating on Table Rock Lake, Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran Church in Kimberling City, Missouri is your Christ-confessing congregation. Every week, Christ comes to us through the preached word and sacraments, by which we are strengthened and kept in the one true faith. So come to where Christ comes to you. Come to Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran Church, 103 Kimberling Boulevard in Kimberling City, Missouri. For more, see our website at sothl.com.
defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues, Etc. 300. Our Savior Lutheran, Westminster, Massachusetts. Redeemer Lutheran, Fairhope, Alabama. St. Matthew Lutheran, Stony Plain, Alberta, Canada. Holy Cross Lutheran, Moline, Illinois. St. Paul Lutheran, Munster, Indiana. St. John Lutheran, Racine, Wisconsin. Calvary Lutheran, Baltimore, Maryland. Reformation Lutheran, Afton, Missouri. Emmanuel Lutheran, Lima, Ohio. Risen Lord Lutheran, Taylorsville, Kentucky. Prince of Peace Lutheran, Crystal Lake, Illinois. And Trinity Lutheran, Elmore, Ohio. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues, Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes a congregational sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues, Etc. journal, the Issues, Etc. 300.
For years in historical Jesus studies, it was assumed that the belief in the resurrection was very, very late. But now we know that belief in the resurrection was an early, early phenomenon. And frankly, historians don't know what to do with that. They just throw their hands up in the air and say, well, I guess something must have happened.
An excerpt from our interview last week with Reza Aslan, author of the book Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. We're responding to some of the things that Reza Aslan had to say in our interview with him. Dr. Montgomery is also the director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. Before we move on, Dr. Montgomery, how can attending the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights help those who attend refute the errors taught by authors like Reza Aslan?
Well, the program does exactly that. It provides the data needed as these screwball misinterpretations of the Bible come about. And this stuff happens all the time. The sad thing is that so few believing Christians have the resources, the ammunition, to deal with issues like this as they arise. And the International Academy, in a two-week period, covers the nine fundamental areas of contemporary apologetics, historical, scientific, literary, medical, legal, and so on down the line, so that when you leave this two-week session, you are armed to take care of precisely the kind of difficulty that we've been talking about in this program. And it's because we don't have that ammunition that our presentation of the gospel is so very weak. You know, in a secular society, it isn't just the gospel that's being presented. All sorts of diverse religious claims are being offered, philosophical alternatives, this kind of thing. And we've got to do exactly what Peter tells us, to be ready always to give an answer. The Greek there is an apology, an apologia, a defense for the hope that is within us. So, you know, we would encourage listeners who want to have a more effective evangelistic ministry with their friends, their family, their community, at the job, to come to the academy and get this kind of training. We're the only Institute of Advanced Studies in Apologetics anywhere. And there are generous scholarships available. We have still a number of $1,000 scholarships that can be provided when people have a need and a reason for it. And that means that the cost of doing this is less than, what, a vacation in Hawaii where you won't learn anything and you'll get a dreadful sunburn.
Find out more about the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Let's see what Mike has to say. He's listening in Kansas City. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi, Pastor Wilkin. And I wish people listening would consider supporting Issues, Etc. It's a great resource. And thank you for coming on the program, Dr. Montgomery. Always love hearing you. Question I had for you, Dr. Montgomery, was that during the interview, Pastor Wilkin pointed out that basically this guy called most of the biblical writers liars. He didn't say that directly, but he implied that, saying that what they said was absolutely not true. But yet, I noticed also that he was very quick to quote Josephus.
And what I've noticed, you know, Josephus had a dubious reputation at best, from my understanding, in that he was perhaps a Jewish traitor even that became Roman. So not that we can't take some of Josephus's writings historically, but still you might question his motives and what he was saying. Is it common for these guys that write this kind of material to just quote people that say what they want them to say without any regard to their reputations?
Mike, thanks for listening. Thanks for listening in Kansas City. Dr. Montgomery.
Well, unfortunately, you're right. What they do is selectively quote the stuff that makes them feel comfortable and doesn't create any problems for the viewpoint that they already maintain. Now, Josephus has valuable historical material, but Josephus had no firsthand contact with Jesus or with the apostolic company. And therefore, if there is any tension, let's say, between what Josephus is saying about Jesus or about early Christianity, and he doesn't say much, but if there is any tension, you're going to have to resolve this in favor of the New Testament materials, because the New Testament materials, in spite of what Reza Aslan says, are eyewitness material. And here I give the audience a reference which is of great importance. This is the best and most comprehensive contemporary work on this subject. This is Richard Baucom, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. Baucom, by the way, is B-A-U-C-K-H-A-M. B-A-U-C-K-H-A-M. Richard Baucom, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. The Gospels as Eyewitness Testimony. This is an English scholar, and the book was published originally in England, but it's published in the United States now as well. And if Reza Aslan had spent, a day with that book, he would have seen the impossibility of the kind of argument that he's presenting.
David is on the line as well. David, thanks for being patient.
Well, no problem. Blessings to you as well as to Pastor Montgomery. My question is regarding to the unbroken chain of written evidence that extends beyond Scripture to the early church fathers, such as the fragments of Papias, Polycarp, even on to Irenaeus, which mentioned their doctrinal heritage through leading back to especially the Apostle John. How, when we have these dates of these Papias being early 2nd century, Polycarp being early to mid 2nd, or maybe late 2nd century, and then Irenaeus a little bit on from there, how do these historical, critical guys deal with the fact that they have this evidence trail leading all the way out into the early church fathers?
David, thank you very much. Good question. Dr. Montgomery?
Yeah, the answer is that they essentially ignore those testimonies or try to say that the testimonies are not really making the point that they're supposed to. In the 19th century, for example, there were attempts to argue that Irenaeus had created the Polycarp material and that Eusebius wasn't reliable in his ecclesiastical history when he presents Papias. And since then, we've found independent material of Papias, for example, that shows that just as everyone should have realized, he was an accurate and careful historian. That evidence trail is of tremendous importance because Papias and Polycarp were both students of the Apostle John, and they say that John told them that Matthew's gospel was written by Matthew Levi, the tax collector, the apostle. Mark's gospel was written by John Mark, an associate of the Apostle Peter. Luke's gospel was written by the physician who accompanied Paul on his missionary journeys. I mean, that kind of corroborating extrinsic evidence is virtually unheard of for other materials of the classical world. Classical historians would sell their grandmothers in order to have that kind of backup for the classical materials. And yet here, that stuff is available to show the historical reliability and legitimacy and eyewitness character of the gospel records. And Jesus Seminar people, religious liberals, secularists, simply ignore it.
During our interview with Reza Aslan last week, I also asked him why he doesn't regard the New Testament Gospels as eyewitness accounts.
They're not. They're not eyewitness accounts because it's a fact. I mean, they were written. We know when the Gospel of Mark was written. We know when the Gospel of Matthew and Luke were written. We know where they were written. And so they were written many years after Jesus' death. So it's not a matter of just an a priori discounting. It's just simply a matter of historical fact. If you come after events, they're not eyewitness accounts. It's as simple as that.
It still sounded to me, Dr. Montgomery, an awful lot like an a priori dismissal of these as eyewitness accounts.
Of course it was, because he's not taking into account the evidence we just talked about. Here's another piece of external evidence, which is extremely important, and he pays no attention to that either. This point was made by Adolf Harnack, the great German historian at the end of the 19th century. Said he, the Book of Acts and the Gospel, according to St. Luke, are clearly written by the same person. There's no doubt about this. And the purpose of the Book of Acts is to give an account of the missionary activity of St. Paul. But at the end of the Acts of the Apostles, St. Paul is still alive. All right, we know that he died in the Neronian persecution in 64-65. That being the case, it's clear that the Acts of the Apostles was written before that, because if Paul had already died and he is the subject of the book, his death would certainly be mentioned. He is taken to Rome at the very end of the Acts of the Apostles, but no mention of his death. That puts the Acts earlier than 64-65, but Luke was written before Acts. And Luke says he relied upon sources. One of these sources, everyone realizes, is Mark, the Gospel of Mark. And Matthew works into this some way. Okay, Jesus died around 30, 33. That means that at least Luke and Mark, those two Gospels, must have been written between 30, 33 or so, the time of Jesus' death, and 64-65. No question about it. That places those two Gospels, and probably Matthew as well, within a generation of the events. That's the kind of thing that turns Reza Aslan's late dating of the Gospels into a fiction. They weren't late documents at all. They were in circulation while hostile witnesses of the events of Jesus' life were alive. And therefore, if these documents had been presenting anything other than the facts, the Jewish religious leaders had the means, motive, and opportunity to show that that was the case. They didn't do it. Why? They couldn't do it.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest for responding to our interview with Reza Aslan, author of a number one New York Times bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. It's Tuesday afternoon, January the 14th. When we come back, we'll hear from Reza Aslan. He's going to give us an example of how he thinks Luke, in particular, rewrote the story of Jesus. Would you like to learn about the Reformation theology you hear on Issues, etc.? We'll send you a pamphlet of Luther's Small Catechism for free. It contains the biblical teachings on the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, the Lord's Supper, and Confession and Absolution. Order your free copy of Luther's Small Catechism today. Just send your name and mailing address to talkback@issuesetc.org.
Does your church need a backup organist? The Virtual Organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
You believe that there's not one error in the Bible. That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues Etc. comment line. Available 24/7. 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
Thank you for helping us make budget again last year. Thanks to your support, Lutheran Public Radio has been independent and in the black for almost 6 years. You've heard us say, now only our listeners can cancel us, and we mean it. Thanks for listening, thanks for your prayers, and thanks for your financial support. Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio for the world, Issues Etc., and sacred music for the world, LutheranPublicRadio.org. We're looking forward to partnering with you in 2014.
Luke knew that that story was factually incorrect. His readers knew that that story is factually incorrect. They didn't care because they understood that what they were reading involved truth, not fact. The facts didn't matter.
Let's raise Aslan. An excerpt from a recent interview we did with him last week. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is with us on this Tuesday afternoon, January the 14th. We're responding to some of the things that Dr. Aslan had to say, some of the claims that he makes in his New York Times bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Dr. Montgomery, getting to the general story of Jesus, focusing on that now, Aslan made some claims in the course of our interview. In particular, he gave as an example Luke's authorship of his gospel, in particular the opening of the gospel, the nativity account, as an example of Luke and the other gospel writers simply rewriting Jesus' story after the fact.
The story of Jesus' birth in Bethlehem. The gospel of Luke says that there is a census in the year 6 AD of the entire Roman world, that Jesus is, like every subject of Rome, forced to uproot himself from like every Roman subject is forced to uproot himself from his home in Nazareth and travel to Bethlehem, the place of his father's birth, in order to be counted, and that's why he's born in Bethlehem. And that's just simply incorrect. First of all, there was a census in 6 AD, but it wasn't of the entire Roman world. It was just of Judea, Idumea, and Perea. So it didn't even count Galilee, which is where Jesus lived, so it wouldn't have affected him in the slightest. And secondly, we know for a fact that Roman law did not require people, the subject citizens, to uproot themselves from the place where they lived and where their property was, which is the whole point of being counted, is to count your property, and travel great distances to the place of your father. That just simply did not happen. Here's the important thing that I want to make. The point that I want to make is that Luke knew that that story was factually incorrect. He was still a Roman citizen living under Roman law. His readers knew that that story is factually incorrect. They were Roman citizens living under Roman law. They didn't care because they understood that what they were reading was an issue that involved truth, not fact. The facts didn't matter.
Dr. Montgomery, your response.
Well, that's a lot of nonsense. The fact of the matter is that we have independent data from the time informing us that there were a number of censuses carried out under the reign of Augustus, all right? There were at least three widespread censuses of Roman citizens, all right? One in 28 B.C., one in 8 B.C., note that Aslan has his dates wrong there, and one in 14 A.D., all right? And there were a considerable number of other local censuses that happened during the time. Luke's account corroborates the idea of multiple censuses because he says this was the first census taken when Quirinius was the governor of Syria. Now, if you check the Greek on that passage, you find that the Greek doesn't say that Quirinius was governor. It uses a term which really refers to a procurator, and that fits what we know from Justin Martyr, because in Justin Martyr's apology, he speaks of Quirinius as a procurator. Thus, the procuratorship undoubtedly preceded the eventual governorship on the part of Quirinius, and the census is not the one that took place in 8 B.C. or 7 at all. It's an earlier census, and that fits perfectly well in the general historical context. A very excellent treatment of this is given by Gleason Archer, my late colleague at the Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. Gleason Archer writes in his Encyclopedia of Biblical Difficulties as follows. He says, get the quotation here, "In order to secure efficiency and dispatch, it may well have been that Augustus put Quirinius in charge of the census enrollment in Syria between the close of Saturnius' administration and the beginning of Varus' term of service in 7 B.C. It was doubtless because of his competent handling of the 7 B.C. census that Augustus later put him in charge of the 7 A.D. census. There isn't any inherent historical contradiction at all in what we have in the passage. And, Reza Aslan has simply not done his homework. And he has assumed that material is mythical and theologically created when it's perfectly obvious that the writer, Luke, is attempting to set forth historical facts. In the days of Caesar Augustus, a decree went out. fine. Also, by the way, there are passages in such Roman records as the Res Gestae that Augustus insisted that even non-Roman citizens acknowledge his authority in vast public activities. And therefore, it may well be that in this one particular census, it was required also of non-Romans to turn up. And we have records of people going back to their own homes in order to take care of official business. So, by the way, it's a nice idea to give the benefit of the doubt to an author and not arrogate it to yourself as critic. This is what Aristotle said. He was irritated by people who were criticizing Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, pointing out contradictions and errors. And Aristotle says, listen, these are not necessarily errors or contradictions, and you give the benefit of the doubt to the author. That's what Reza Aslan and other liberal critics of the Bible do not do. They don't give the benefit of doubt to the biblical writers, and surely those writers deserve it at least as much as secular writers, and one might expect maybe a little bit more consideration for them.
We'll take another break. When we come back, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. We're going to hear from Reza Aslan. He has an answer to a question that I posed to him. It's a simple question, and it begins a series that we will continue with as the next hour continues. Who did Jesus himself, think he was? We'll get Reza Aslan's answer to that question, and then we'll get Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's response to that question. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Bedfordshire in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, and author and editor of more than 50 books, including History, Law, and Christianity, and his latest, Christ as Center and Circumference. You can purchase his books under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. We'll continue with Dr. Montgomery on the other side of the break, responding to our interview with Reza Aslan, author of a number one New York Times bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. As time permits, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris will be our guest. joining us from the Ruth Institute, where we'll get her thoughts on a new study on marriage and poverty, and then part two of our series on witnessing Christ with Dr. John Seiss, author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for January, Five Things You Can Do to Witness Christ. We'll be talking about law and gospel. Stay tuned.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
Thankful for God's service through the pastors in your life? Then consider attending Christ for Us in the Office of the Holy Ministry, a conference of the Association of Confessing Evangelical Lutheran Congregations, this coming February 25th through 27th in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Visit our website at acelc.net for information on Christ for Us in the Office of the Ministry. Register online at acelc.net.
I guess what I would say is that Jesus thought that he was the Messiah, but when he said Messiah, he meant probably what every Jew meant when he said Messiah, the descendant of King David, here to usher in the kingdom of God. But of course, he didn't do that. He was as successful in doing what the Messiah was supposed to do as all the other so-called false messiahs, and that's where we get to where we started this conversation, which is that confronted with the fact that Jesus didn't do what the Messiah was supposed to do, the disciples had two choices. Either he wasn't the Messiah, or what we think the Messiah is incorrect, that the Messiah means something else, and they chose the latter.
As Ray Aslan, from a recent interview we did with him, he's author of a New York Times number one bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. On this Tuesday afternoon, January the 14th, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. We're responding to some of the things that Dr. Aslan had to say during that interview. Dr. Montgomery, I'd like your response to that. When asked, you know, who did Jesus think he was? Well, he thought he was the Messiah, but he would have meant simply a human successor to David's throne. In essence, the leader of all the zealots.
Well, even Reza Aslan admits that when Jesus uses the expression Son of Man for himself, he's referring to Ezekiel and Daniel, where the Son of Man is an apocalyptic figure who comes on the clouds of heaven to sum up history. When Jesus was before the high priest in Matthew, the high priest says, "Are you the one?" And Jesus says, "You said it, legate, you said it, and you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with all the heavenly host." And the reaction of the high priest is, "What need do we have of further witnesses? He blasphemes." There's no question but what the contemporary Jewish leaders understood this as a divine claim, as nothing less than the claim of God come to earth. And that's backed up by all sorts of statements that Jesus makes, which, of course, Reza Aslan ignores, such as, "Before Abraham was, I am." Now, you know, if Jesus is little more than a messianic political leader, it's awfully strange that he is claiming preexistence. Before Abraham was, I am, and the Jews of Jesus' time saw exactly what that was. This was Jesus claiming to be the divine Messiah, the Messiah who represented and was, in fact, God come to earth. Now, this is just another illustration of the fact that Reza Aslan is engaged in a selective process. He is not taking into account all the data. And if you engage in that kind of selectivity, you are a lousy historian, or you are not. In the case of Reza Aslan, it isn't simply that he's a lousy historian. He's not a historian at all. And when he claims to be such, as he does in that interview again and again, as a historian and so forth, he's not a historian. He has no training as a historian, nor as a theologian. You know, in medicine, if you practice it without a license, you go to jail. And I happen to be a lawyer in three countries, and if you practice law without a license, you go to jail. But the remarkable thing is that in the area of theology, any nincompoop can make outlandish assertions, and not only does the person not go to jail, but there are a considerable number of people who will listen and actually accept that sort of thing. In the old days, I think it was Mrs. Roosevelt, the wife of President Roosevelt, who did articles on religion for the Ladies' Home Companion magazine, Eleanor Roosevelt. Why anybody in his right mind would listen to Eleanor Roosevelt on that subject, or why anyone in his right mind would listen to Reza Aslan on the issue of what Jesus thinks of himself, is beyond my comprehension. This is a final proof of original sin and the fall of man.
Closely related to how Jesus thought of himself is how Jesus thought of his own ministry. Here's Dr. Aslan's response.
Here's how I would answer that question as a historian. 99% of that ministry, indeed every minute of his ministry except for the last few days of it, was spent not just in Galilee, but in the backwoods of Galilee, in the small towns, the small villages. You know, he assiduously avoided big cities, and he absolutely avoided Judea, and almost treated Jerusalem like it was, you know, the plague. I mean, he stayed as far from Jerusalem as he possibly could. And then one day, out of the blue, for reasons that we can only guess, he says to his disciples, "Let's go to Jerusalem." And not only does he say, "Let's go to Jerusalem," but he decides to enter Jerusalem in about the most provocative way possible. You know, he declares himself king in that triumphal entry into Jerusalem when he's riding on a donkey, the way that the prophet Zechariah says that the king shall enter Jerusalem. He takes part in this dramatically violent act in the temple, which would have been instantly punishable by death. In other words, it's almost as though he is courting his own death. It's almost as though he is deliberately trying to get the attention of the authorities who more or less have ignored him up to this point.
What do you make of that characterization of how Jesus regards his own ministry, Dr. Montgomery?
Well, there's no indication that Jesus stayed away from Jerusalem because he didn't like big cities, and that he then engineered his own death by coming to Jerusalem. I mean, again, you don't find that kind of interpretation presented by the eyewitnesses or by those who had immediate contact with the eyewitnesses. If you want to know about somebody's ministry, somebody's life, somebody's activities, and if you want to know how he regards those, what do? You go to the best sources and you pay attention to what is actually being presented there. You do not speculate and create a scenario which, as a matter of fact, contradicts what you find in the materials that provide you the solid information. That's why what's going on here is not historical scholarship. It is really the writing of fiction. I mean, this book should not be classified in a library in the theology section. It should be classified in the fiction section, or maybe in autobiography, because it really tells you more about the author, Reza Aslan, than it does about Jesus.
I guess kind of coming around full circle, having talked about Jesus' conception of himself, his conception of his ministry, according to Reza Aslan, the next logical question would be, how did Jesus regard his own death? Here's what Dr. Aslan had to say.
As a historian, you have to stop and think about what is the motivation for that, to really say to the disciples, let's go kill ourselves. And to me, because, you know, I myself do not believe that Jesus was the incarnate God, I have to look to his human motivations for that. And what I think that he is doing is recognizing that without, you know, his death, without this sort of dramatic expression of his values, his identity, at the heart of the beast, right at the temple where both Rome and the priestly authorities, his two greatest enemies, reside, was a way for him to make sure that his ministry, that his teachings actually matter, that people hear it, that his fight for the poor and the dispossessed and the marginalized is something that has to be confronted by the authorities themselves.
How do you respond to that? He characterizes Jesus' death, at least in Jesus' own mind, as a dramatic expression of his values.
Your
response?
Martyrdom in behalf of the outcasts. Well, it's an interesting theory. The only problem with it is that it has absolutely no basis in historical fact. What we find in the accounts is Jesus fulfilling Old Testament prophecy and thereby reinforcing again and again the fact that he is the divine Messiah. He says, I come to give my life a ransom for many, that he is dying to take the sins of the world on himself and expiating those sins to make it possible for people to come back to the Father. That's what you find in the accounts, not the kind of analysis that you get with Reza Aslan. And, of course, he admits that he, first of all, refuses to take Jesus as Jesus presents himself. He refuses to accept Jesus as the incarnate Son of God, okay, in spite of what Jesus says. And therefore, he's reduced to trying to find some kind of humanistic explanation of Jesus' acts. Which simply goes to show that if your preconceptions are bad enough, they will corrupt absolutely what you're doing.
When we come back, a few more minutes with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. We're responding to our interview late last week with Reza Aslan, author of a number one New York Times bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is author and editor of more than 50 books, including History, Law, and Christianity. And his latest is called Christ as Center and Circumference. We'll be right back.
International human rights attorney and law professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on the importance of issues, etc.
Before settling in England and France, I had my own Christian radio program for 10 years in California and 2 years in Washington State. I was also a regular for over a decade on national religious television. In a word, I have had a great deal of contact with evangelical programming, both good and bad, and my judgment in this area is probably worth something. In my opinion, Issues Etc. is one of the very few programs on Christian radio willing to discuss tough questions with solid theological answers. I consider it a great privilege to be able to appear on the program regularly, and I commend it to every serious listener.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift today. Donate online at issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Defending the faith, teaching the truth. Issues Etc.
Expert guests. Expansive topics. Extolling Christ. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January only costs $7.99. It's titled, Five Things You Can Do to Witness Christ. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Five Things You Can Do to Witness Christ by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, equipping you to witness Christ on the front lines. Five Things You Can Do to Witness Christ.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The Virtual Organist Service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
What you're misunderstanding is the difference between myth and fact in the gospel. So, in other words, the belief in the resurrection, the fact that Jesus rose from the dead, is something that the early Christian community would have accepted as fact. The stories about Jesus' resurrection, those are myths. That's what I'm trying to explain to you. Each one of those stories is a myth whose facts are not important, but whose truth, the truth that they reveal, are what's important.
That's Dr. Asa Aslan, author of Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. We interviewed him late last week and were responding to some of the things he had to say in the course of that interview with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, Professor Emeritus at the University of Bedfordshire in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States, and director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. Dr. Montgomery, one of the things that we dealt with briefly before in the course of our conversation is this notion of history. And I wanted to pursue this a little bit more with Reza Aslan. At one point, his assertion is that, in essence, the ancient people really couldn't conceive of our concept of history.
It's a very difficult thing for the modern mind to understand, because what you and I call history is wholly a product of the modern world. What you and I define to be history, the accumulation of facts and figures and dates, is barely 300 years old. That definition of history would have been wholly foreign to the ancient mind, whether they are the gospel writers, or whether they are Herodotus, or whether they are Philo the Elder, or whether they are, Josephus.
Dr. Montgomery, I'd like your complete response to that, if you would.
It's absolutely false. It's absolutely false. The ancients knew perfectly well the difference between myth and historical fact, and that's why historians, classical historians such as Herodotus and Thucydides, were not classified along with Homer and Virgil as writing fiction. They knew perfectly well the difference. And at the beginning of the program, I cited 2 Peter 1:16. Where the apostle says, "We have not followed myths when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty." That shows, number one, that the writer, the apostle, understood the difference between mythology and history. And it shows, number two, that for him, for something to be historical, it was vitally important to have eyewitness testimony. Now, that is exactly what the modern historian maintains. It's historical chauvinism when somebody gives the impression that the poor folk centuries ago really didn't know their heads from a hole in the ground, and suddenly, in the last 300 years, we have really matured to the point where we understand the difference between fact and fiction. Nonsense! this is simply not true. That's a mythology. That's a mythology. That kind of understanding of a difference between the modern man who understands facts and the ancients who had no clear notion of the difference between fact and fiction, that is a myth. And that kind of mythology is convenient because it means that you then don't have to pay serious attention to historical records prior to modern times. This cuts you off from the past. It removes most of history from having that quality at all. So the issue with someone like Reza Aslan is not just a theological issue. It has to do with what someone like this does to scholarship in general. This is the ruination of any kind of serious scholarship. The man is not only not a historian, in spite of his claims, not only not a theologian, in spite of the fact that he's doing theology, but he is a walking catastrophe as far as scholarship in general is concerned. And if people listen to someone like this, that's going to corrupt their ability to make sense out of a factual reality in general.
I asked Reza Aslan why he didn't treat the New Testament Gospels in particular like other ancient histories of the time.
We do, as a matter of fact. So I'll give you one example. Concurrent with the writing of the Gospels is the work of a great Jewish historian and Roman citizen by the name of Flavius Josephus. Josephus, in the end of the first century, wrote a massive history of the Jews and then a second history of the Jewish war that ultimately resulted in the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70. Now, Josephus is not writing about gods or messiahs. He's not a theologian. He's not making, faith statements at all. He's trying as hard as possible to just simply tell an accurate story. He calls himself a historian. But even so, we know that a lot of the claims that Josephus makes do not actually match what we know about the history of the time. And we realize that, of course, Josephus is writing his history for the Emperor Titus, the man who actually destroyed Jerusalem. So, for instance, we know that Titus and his troops deliberately burned Jerusalem to the ground, deliberately razed the temple in Jerusalem as punishment for the Jewish revolt. Josephus says, oh no, it was an accident, and Titus did everything in his power to try to put out the fire, and it was not his fault that the city and the temple of God burned to the ground. Well, obviously that's not true. I mean, obviously he is saying that because he wants to ingratiate himself to his benefactor.
All right, here's the question I got, Dr. Montgomery. He's saying, okay, the ancient historian Josephus wasn't giving the straight facts on this. He says, we know better. All right. So if ancient history is not reliable because everyone's writing to please their benefactor, to what history does he have access that gainsays ancient history, much less the New Testament accounts? He seems to say, well, we know better now because we have – is he saying we have access to better historical records, or we simply can presume better than the people who were there writing these things down?
Well, you're perfectly right. In order for him to make that judgment about Josephus, he has to have better and more accurate historical information. And there are other accounts of the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of Jerusalem, and there may well be reasons to prefer some of that to what Josephus has to say. But this doesn't make the point that Reza Aslan is trying to make anyway. This doesn't say that Josephus didn't know the difference between fact and fiction. All it says is that he was a writer who was willing to act in a sycophantic manner in relation to the emperor. And all the way through history, we've had people who are writing in order to please somebody else. There's no doubt about that, but that doesn't mean that they don't know the difference between fact and fiction. In order to make Reza Aslan's point, he would have to be able to show, for example, that Josephus was consciously providing an alternative story that he, Josephus, didn't think was true at all for the purpose of a new mythology. And that's not what's going on in the slightest. We admit that historians can pervert data and make mistakes. Everybody knows that. You assume that a writer is truthful unless there is reason to think otherwise, unless you've got better historical documentation to show that that's not the case. And all we're saying in the case of the New Testament is that there isn't any better historical data concerning Jesus or the rise of the early church than what we have in those documents. And therefore, we need to go with those documents, especially when they make clear that they are trying to present historical fact and not some kind of mythology.
Folks, I want your reaction to our interview with Race Aslan, author of a New York Times bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. A few more minutes with Dr. John Wart Montgomery on the other side of this break. But this break is a great time to give us a call. We are coming to you live this Tuesday afternoon, the 14th of January, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Your reaction to our interview with Race Aslan. Our email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at issuesetc. That call the number again. This break, a great time to call, 1-877-623-6943.
Common and experienced firsthand by sitting down in classes and actually hearing professors, coming to chapel, which is always the high point of the day, to hear the word of God and to lift our voices in song.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Paul Grimm on why you should consider visiting Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Spend time talking to professors. I mean, there's not a professor here who will not be willing to take time, whether it's after chapel during the coffee hour or just to come into one's study and sit down and talk for a while, to answer questions, to help them to get a sense of, A, do they want to be a pastor or a deaconess? And then B, is this the right place? And, well, maybe C would be the question, is now the right time for them to make that decision?
If you've contemplated the vocation of pastor or deaconess, contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or send an email to admission@ctsfw.edu.
In the 1500s, the Reformers grieved over the view people had of their callings in life, believing work done for the church superior to work done anywhere else. So the Reformers worked to restore a proper balance. But as it's written in Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun. 600 years later, with the thought of everyone a minister, haven't we gone back? The CLCC has released a new seminar on the doctrine of vocation, an important Lutheran teaching that has fallen into disuse over the years. The solution is to start teaching it once again. The seminar contains four lessons, with a standalone overview lesson available for circuit convocations. Serving our neighbors through our vocations is essential for the task of evangelism practiced according to Scripture. Contact us to schedule your seminar today at theclcc.org. That's theclcc.org. And please, consider joining the CLCC or making a donation to help us bring these powerful but low-cost seminars to the laity. theclcc.org.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Christ at the Center, the Justification of the Ungodly, a Contemporary View of Faith and Reason, the Holy Spirit in Christ. These are just some of the almost 30 essays included in Propter Christum, Christ at the Center. It's a new book of essays in honor of Issues, Etc. regular guest, Pastor Daniel Preuss. Find out more and purchase Propter Christum at shop.logia.org. Propter Christum, Christ at the Center, shop.logia.org.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. A few more minutes with him. Then Dr. Jennifer Roback Marsh will join us. We'll talk about a new study on marriage and poverty. Bill is on the line. He listens in St. Louis. Hi, Bill.
Hi, I've been following this thing with a lot of interest, and I've noticed that this Mr. Aslan, he said more than once in your interview that regarding the New Testament, that it was true, but the facts were wrong. And that contradiction in itself, to me, completely discredits the man.
Bill, thank you very much. Thanks for listening in St. Louis. What are your thoughts there, Dr. Montgomery?
Well, yes, there's no doubt about that. This, however, is a kind of contemporary existential approach to truth. The truth is a matter of subjectivity. It's a matter of one's personal stance, the way one looks at the world. It doesn't necessarily have to do with the factual nature of things. And arising from this is the notion you'll hear from people. Well, that's your faith. I just don't happen to believe that way. That's one of the most serious problems in evangelism today. That's one of the issues that we deal with at the International Academy of Apologetics each year. It's so important to help people to realize that facts are of critical importance to belief. If belief sort of floats free and it really doesn't make any difference that it has any factual connections, then, of course, any belief is of equivalent value to any other belief. Would we really want to go along with that kind of notion? For example, what about the conviction of virtually the entire German people during the 1930s that National Socialism was the way to move forward? I mean, look at those Nuremberg rallies where all of these people are saying Heil Hitler and all the rest of it. When you have a medical problem, is it simply a question of what you personally believe would be nice as a remedy? Don't you want to go to a doctor who will analyze the facts and find out what's really the matter with you and will match a remedy to the factual difficulty you're facing? If this is the case in life in general, then surely we ought to look at religious questions that way. We ought to ask ourselves not how comfortable is it to believe this or how many people believe that. We ought to ask ourselves, is this worthy of belief? In other words, is there the kind of factual basis so that we can connect our belief with what is true? And unless we do this, we are engaged in an activity which is as dangerous as taking remedies that make us feel nice, that we like, rather than remedies that will actually take care of the disease or medical problem that we have. You take aspirin. You take poison because it looks nice rather than aspirin for a headache, and it's going to kill you.
Finally, we were concluding our conversation with Reza Aslan, and I thought the best way to kind of summarize our conversation was to ask him, how do you decide, when you look at the New Testament, what is myth and what is fact?
If I were to put it in its simplest way possible, it would be this. Although we know very little about the historical Jesus himself, we know a lot about the world in which he lived. First century Palestine is an era that was very well documented, thanks to the Romans, who were, if anything, adept at documentation. So we know a lot about Jesus' world. What we do is we take the claims of the Gospels and we analyze them according to what we know about the history of the time and place that Jesus lived. And if they match, then they're more likely to be historically accurate, and if they don't, then they're not.
Classic definition of higher criticism there, or historical criticism. Dr. Montgomery, what's its fault?
Well, a couple of things to that. First of all, isn't it interesting that he says that the Romans were adept at documentation? I thought he had said previously that a concern with documentation and fact was something that had only come about in the last 300 years, and that people of that time really didn't know the difference between myth and fact. If that were the case, why were the Romans so concerned with documentation, pray tell? Okay, that's one point, but the more important point connected with this, it seems to me, is that when we're dealing with an event historically, or when we're dealing with a person, we must not take the general picture of the time and impose that on that individual. If we do that, what we're actually doing is taking a generalized description of a time, and we are creating an individual who conforms to it. A proper approach historically is to work in just the other direction. You work from the individual to the general societal picture, not going from the general society to the individual. Why is this? It's because people do not need to conform in every respect to the pattern of their time. The great men of history have not conformed to their time. If we took the general picture of, let's say, France at the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th century, and then we force Napoleon into that schema, we'd no longer have Napoleon. You've got to start with Napoleon and find out what he was like and what his beliefs were and what his activities actually consisted of. And then you can maybe fill in some background details from the time. What Aslan is doing here is to begin with the secular pattern of life in the first century, as he sees it, or the Jewish pattern of activity, general patterns of activity in the first century, and then he's turning Jesus into a reflection of that sort of thing. And that conforms exactly to his notion that Jesus is no more than human, and therefore he can be conformed to his time. The people who actually had contact with Jesus, the people who wrote the New Testament, and the people who heard Jesus, were amazed by the fact that he was so different, that no man has spoken as he spoke. That's why Christianity triumphed in the Roman world, because there wasn't anybody like Jesus, and nobody who did what he did. Nobody rose from the dead and conquered the powers of death. So what you've got in Aslan is a piece of reductionism, where Jesus is reduced to the time in which he lives. And if you do this for any historical figure, you will never, never be faithful to that historical figure, and you will never understand the historical figure. That may not be terribly important when it comes to Napoleon, but it is desperately important when it comes to Jesus Christ, because there, if you take him as he was and at his word, salvation is available. And if you don't, there isn't any, because he said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me."
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Bedfordshire in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, and author and editor of more than 50 books, including History, Law, and Christianity. His latest is called Christ as Center and Circumference. You'll find links to Dr. Montgomery's books and to the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Montgomery, thank you very much for your time.
You're most welcome.
Folks, if you appreciate the timely response to best-selling books like Zealot by Raisa Aslan, please consider becoming a monthly or annual contributor to Issues Etc. in 2014. This is called our Issues Etc. Reformation Club. You can find out more about the benefits of becoming an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. When we come back, Dr. Jennifer Oback Morse is going to be with us. We're going to talk about a new study on marriage and poverty. It's Tuesday afternoon, January the 14th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Messiah Lutheran, Seattle, Washington, Grace Lutheran, McPherson, Kansas, St. Paul's Lutheran, Bridgeport, Nebraska, Our Savior Lutheran, Raleigh, North Carolina, St. Paul Lutheran, Hancock, Maryland, Messiah Lutheran, Keller, Texas, St. John's Lutheran, Maple Grove, Minnesota, Grace Lutheran, Parker, Colorado, and Our Redeemer Lutheran, Harrington, Kansas. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
The faith once for all delivered to the saints. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In Higher Things, we believe that if you put good Christ crucified for you Lutheranism into a youth, you'll get a good Christ crucified for you Lutheran youth. Join us this July at the Higher Things Crucified Youth Conferences in Florida, Wisconsin, Utah. Check us out at www.higherthings.org. Higherthings.org. Dare your youth to be Lutherans this summer.
Join me for a Lenten preaching workshop Monday, January the 20th at Concordia Lutheran Church in Geneseo, Illinois. I'll be teaching on current problems in Lutheran preaching and biblical remedies for these problems. The registration fee is only $15 and includes lunch. For more information, contact Pastor Gary Wright at 309-236-3882. I'm looking forward to meeting you in Geneseo, Illinois on January the 20th. 309-236-3882.